This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
My name is Wendell Van Auken, but everyone calls me Van. That's why it says Van Van Auken on the program. Just something in my family, all the male heirs are called Van, no matter what their first name is. So I just thought I'd briefly tell you a little bit about why I'm here and my involvement with UCSF. My involvement goes back 20 years. I like to say that I'm a graduate of the Peter Carroll form of treatment back in 1996 when I had prostate cancer, and he operated on me, and I haven't had to have any treatment since then. But I'm still very interested in all these new approaches that are coming out. After having gone through that treatment, I was very interested in what I saw at UCSF and the collaborative nature and the research that was being done here, and the world-class researchers, scientists, and doctors working here. And so I got actively involved with Peter and Eric Small and a few others just help bring a patient perspective to the prostate cancer program. And that has gone on for quite a few years. And then I'm actually a two-cancer family. My wife contracted lung cancer about 10 years ago. And, of course, we came to UCSF, and she was very well-treated, and she was also cured by surgery here at UCSF and has not had to have more treatment. But our focus as a family then shifted more to lung cancer because the results and the progress that has been made in lung cancer has been rather dismal compared to breast cancer or prostate cancer. Just as a statistic, most people may not know that twice as many women die of lung cancer every year than of breast cancer, and it's because the cure rate is so dismal for lung cancer. So there's a lot of progress being made now in lung cancer. It reminds me of where prostate cancer was 20 years ago. So that has been an interest of ours, and we've been funding programs with Eric Small in the lung cancer oncology and research. And then there's one other area of interest to us, and that is on the back of your brochure here. We have this new Precision Cancer Medicine building, which if you haven't gotten any familiarity with, you should, because this is going to be a world-shattering new approach to treating patients with cancer, all in one facility, all in one common building with everything that they need. And so that's been our most recent initiative to support that program, and with the help of Melanie Rainin and Peter Carroll and Eric Small, we've made a significant contribution to that building. So let me briefly introduce, as you see up here on the slide, the four speakers who will be talking today. And we have Dr. Louis Lanier, who's the J. Michael Bishop Distinguished Professor, Chairman of the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at UCSF, and also is a leader of the immunity program in the UCSF Helen Diller Comprehensive Cancer Center, along with many other things. And his research group studies the natural killer cells, so-called NK, which recognize and eliminate cells that have become transformed or affected by virus. Then we have Dr. Dow right here, who is the next one down the line, a medical oncologist who specializes in immunotherapy for melanoma and skin cancer. Oh, I forgot. I'm also a skin cancer survivor, but it's only basal cell, so I haven't had to come to UCSF. And so he's head of the melanoma program at the Helen Diller Comprehensive Cancer Center, and has led clinical trials for the PD-1 antibody, which is now known as Keytruda. So he's developed new treatments for melanoma. And then we have Dr. Hope Rugo, professor of medicine at in Division of Hematology Oncology and Helen Diller Comprehensive Cancer Center. And she works in the breast cancer and clinical trial education. She's the only one of the five of us who's been associated with UCSF longer than me. So she has the record. I think I'm not going to say how many years because that's up to her if she wants to divulge that. But she's seen it all here at UCSF. And then last but not least, we have Larry Fong, who's the Ifo Guzik Distinguished Professor in Cancer Biology at the Helen Diller Comprehensive Cancer Center, where he leads the cancer immunology program. And he's a physician scientist in the Department of Medicine, Hematology, and Oncology, directing both the NIH R01-funded research lab as well as the clinical research program. And he's been, maybe he'll give us a little of the history of cancer immunotherapy since he's been working on it for 20 years. And I think, as I recall, 20 years ago, I don't think we had the technology to do what we do now. So I don't know if anybody's going to talk about how technology has enabled this whole field, but I think it's undoubtedly the case that technology of all forms has made this possible. It's not just only medicine by itself, in a sense.
I'm Louis Lanier, and I'm a mouse doctor. I started out curing mice of cancer with the immune system in 1975, and we now can do it in people. So I'm really excited about what's happened. Nobody thought that would work. And I worked in biotech for 20 years before I came to UCSF in 1999, and there, most pharmaceutical firms and biotech thought the immune system was kind of a curiosity. So it really flipped about 7 years ago, I think, was when we appreciated that the new drugs don't attack the cancer directly. They help your immune system do its own job. So conceptually, all your immune cells, my favorite ones are these cells called natural killer cells, about 20% of your blood, that were found back in the 70s to spontaneously kill tumor cells or virally infected cells. But the way they work applies to all types of immune cells. That is, when you have a T cell or an NK cell, when it's bumping into cells in your body, asking, are those cells okay? They're kind of getting two types of information. First, they need to see something on the infected cell or the tumor cell to get them excited. But what we didn't appreciate until I think kind of the mid-90s was that your immune system has to have as many fail-safes as it does go buttons. Otherwise, you get autoimmune disease. And often, when you get autoimmune diseases, the fail-safes aren't working. In the mid-90s, Jim Allison, who was at the time at Berkeley and had a graduate student named Max Crummell, who's now a professor in pathology here, they said, well, what if we transiently block those fail-safes and let your immune system do its job for a little while? If you have cells that already see the cancer and we block the fail-safe for a little while, it'll allow those cells to have their full potential and go after the cancer. So essentially, every time one of your immune cells bumps into one of your other tissues, it's kind of making decisions. It's getting go signals, but simultaneously there are what are called these inhibitory receptors that suppress or block the activation. This is really important not to get autoimmune disease, but on the other hand, this has allowed this new revolution in cancer therapy of just stopping those guys for a little while. So my second slide was going to tell you about the different immune receptors that are currently in the clinic. So in the immune system, you have about 200 different proteins on the surface of your immune cells, different kinds of immune cells, that are the stop signals. the weight slow down. The two you'll hear about today from Adil and Hope and Larry, you've probably seen in the press, are one of them is called ipilimumab, which is a molecule called CTLA-4. Another one, there's a variety of different clinical, there's 14 companies making various antibodies to block this thing called PD-1. But the concept is quite simple. You come in with a reagent, often an antibody, to just mask that inhibitory receptor. And as Larry and Dill and the guys will tell you, that got really remarkable responses. The curious thing is, unlike the when you put in a poison, a chemotherapy, the doctors look for the tumor to shrink, you know, within a couple of days because the poison is working directly on the cancer cell. With these immune therapies, when you block the inhibiting receptor, you have to allow some time for your immune cells to expand. The army has to get bigger. So there's often a four-month lag between when you mask those receptors until the army expands and starts doing its job. But now, as Adil knows from his many patients, up to 20% of stage 4 melanoma patients are alive today and living more than 10 years by masking that one receptor. Our job is to say, well, can we use the science of what we know about these other inhibitory receptors to combine therapies in order to take that 20% and make it 50%, make it 70%, using the basic things that we've learned over the last 35 years about all these receptors. When I started in graduate school, we didn't know what the activating receptors were. We didn't know what the inhibiting receptors were. And I've been fortunate enough in my career to help identify some of those receptors and come up with this basic concept of how this works. So with that, I'll hand it over, and you can hear about how this stuff actually works in the clinic. Adil?
So, you know, there's a lot of interesting things going on in the immunotherapy field, but, you know, I think some of you have experienced this at firsthand, but one of the challenges for us is that, you know, trying to figure out who does not respond to PD-1 and what we can learn from those patients and try to see how we can improve that. So what we know is that if you have a tumor that looks like this under the microscope, which doesn't have a lot of T cells, a lot of those tumors will not respond to PD-1. And you can see that in this patient. And that is, even today, that's the majority of patients with melanoma, and certainly the majority of patients with other types of tumors like you know, lung cancer and head and neck cancer and... you know, cervical cancer and breast cancer. So we could say that if you have a tumor that looks like this, you know, this person who had this great response, a lot of those tumors under the microscope look like this. They're basically full of T cells. They're full of, you know, what the immunologists call dendritic cells, and they have this pre-existing immune response that, in a sense, you're exploiting by what Lewis was just talking about, just basically blocking one of the key checkpoints. And so I think we're at a point today, which is, you know, different than, you know, 2011 when we first started trials with the PD-1 drugs, where we could say of these patients, a lot, maybe 20% of them or perhaps even a higher number will be either cured or at least long-term, you know, disease-free, if that's the right word to use. But I think the big challenge is what do you do about these tumors? And I think the one, just shorthand description of these types of tumors is to call them cold, meaning that they're not T cell infiltrated. So one of the approaches that there's many different theories about what exactly is going on with these cold tumors. Is it the tumor itself? Is it the immune environment? Is it something about the person? Is it even something like the gut flora? Which I see Larry right here. So I with your permission, I'd like to kind of relate this anecdote about what happened. You know, he was one of the first patients on PD-1, and actually had a nice response. He's like over a year, I want to say. And then for reasons that are not clear to me today, we took him off the PD-1. And then soon afterwards, the tumor started growing again. And then we put him back on PD-1. And then, at that time, I was thinking, this is not going to work. It's probably, you know, since the tumor progressed so quickly. And he said, well, why don't I try this probiotic from Whole Foods? I was like, yeah, right. Like, that's going to do anything, you know? And lo and behold, he took that probiotic and actually that's put the tumor back into a complete response. So I still remember, I think it's called 365 or something like that, right?
Oh, that's, it, like
that's sorry. So, but there is actually this theory now that your microbial flora, I guess, is, you know, in some mice experiments and even in some human experiments, it looks like that in some way controls your, you know, it's kind of a rheostat that controls your immune system. But one approach we have taken is using interleukin 12, which, polarizes your immune system towards a Th1 response. And there's many different ways of doing it. You know, some people have used viruses. We've used this shock therapy which actually Larry has also been, you know, participant in, I should say. So one of the things that we've seen from the interleukin 12 experiments is that if you look at this patient here who had actually did not respond to interleukin 12, so this was a patient who had a progressive disease, you could see that even in this patient, started off here, and by cycle 2, day 1, you could see that in the lesions that had interleukin 12 put in, you could see a lot of immune response there. And in fact, you can even see in the non-treated lesion, this is a lesion somewhere else in this person's body, you could see that response. And you could see the same thing in a patient who had a complete response. So I think this points to the possibility, I guess, of using different types of cytokines and some of the checks and balances that, you know, Lewis was talking about in the immune system and exploiting some of those checks and balances to take the cold tumor and turn it hot, you know, if that's the right word to use. And I think there's other interesting developments in our field too. Like this patient, she had a groin lesion, and you could see that right here. And on this PET scan here, you could see that over here on the CT scan. And this is a patient who actually, I had sent her to the surgeon, and the surgeon said, well, the tumor is wrapped around some blood vessels. We can't take it out. So we put her on Ipi-Nivo, which is one of the, you know, latest and greatest immunotherapies in our field. It's a combination of CTLA-4 antibody and PD-1 antibody. And this tumor grew through that. And so then we put her on this study, which is a combination of PI3 kinase inhibitor along with PD-1. And it's an interesting theory. I think for the longest time we've thought in immunotherapy that what you need in the case of cancer immunotherapy is to expose that, you know, immune system to more of the antigen. But there's a countervailing school, I guess, of thought, which is that these T cells are too immersed in antigen, and maybe you need to, you know, reduce signaling through that T cell receptor. And there's, you know, many different concepts out there. But one concept is to use a PI3 kinase blocker along with PD-1. And sure enough, this patient has had a complete response. She had, this was a scan in December. And you could see that tumor has totally disappeared. So I don't know for sure if there's, this is just like one of those N equals one kinds of events where, you know, they say you shouldn't be building a castle out of these. But I think it's eye-opening to me in the sense that, you know, there could be many different classes of PD-1 non-responders, I guess. And there's maybe, different ways of exploiting the immune response in people. And one way, which seems counterintuitive, is to, you know, transiently reduce signaling through the T cell receptor. So not exposing the person to more antigen, but actually removing some of that T cell signaling and letting that exhausted T cell re-equilibrate, if that's, you know, the right word to use. So, I just want to end with this patient who was on one of our clinical trials, and this is Linda McCulloch. She's a chef who works in Napa. She was driving, and this is in July 2015. She had, she kind of had to pull over to the side because she had a seizure and drove her car into a ditch. They brought her over to the hospital in Napa, and she had this tumor in her brain and other tumors too. So we started her on ipi/nivo, and that's her scans from January to 2017. It has not had any radiation, has not had anything beyond just immune therapy, which is not something that you would have done, prior to, 2017 or 2016. And she sent me all these nice pictures. She went on a wine day. They have done all kinds of things with their family, since then. And we don't have a lot of follow-up, but I do think that it's likely that she's not going to have to deal with melanoma anymore. And I think that for somebody who has had brain metastases, that's a pretty amazing thing to say. I've been dealing with this tumor for many years now, and we were doing all kinds of things and sending patients to the surgeons and doing radiation treatment. And we recognize the side effects of all of those treatments, but just using your immune system to get rid of cancer, that's a pretty amazing kind of thing. And I think you guys will hear more from Dr. Rugo and Dr. Fong.
Great. So I'm Hope Rugo, and I'm a breast medical oncologist and run our breast clinical trials and clinical trial education at the Cancer Center. And breast cancer, we're in a different world with immunotherapy than we are with many other things. So we always talk about breast cancer as being sort of a world of riches. We have a lot of different treatments, but we still have patients who are progressing and dying of this disease. It's the most common cancer diagnosed worldwide in women. Thankfully, in the United States, it's not the most common cause of cancer death, as you heard earlier, because we have many effective therapies, but because it's such a frequent diagnosed disease, 1 out of 8 women in the U.S. will develop breast cancer, we still deal with a lot of disease that isn't going to be cured by our current therapies. In other parts of the world, which is relatively sobering, it is the most common cause of cancer death in women because there isn't the access to the same therapeutic modalities that we have here. One of the things we've known since the days of interferon being treated when patients with melanoma were being treated with interferon, and we thought of when I was training a fairly long time ago, that melanoma was just a disease there was nothing to do anything for. There just weren't any treatments that worked. And what we had interferon that was a very toxic therapy at the time. People would come in the hospital, stay in the intensive care unit, but some of the patients' cancers would respond. Well, of course, there was a lot of interest in breast cancer then, but breast cancer patients didn't respond. And over the course of the next couple of decades, we came to understand, with the help of our colleagues that you have heard and will hear during this session, that breast cancer isn't a very immunogenic disease. In other words, maybe it has a little bit to do with the fact that women carry another need to have the ability to carry a foreign body, in other words, to get pregnant and not reject that pregnancy. Maybe it has to do with the fact that the breast makes milk, and so we don't, as humans, react to that cancer as being so foreign, so we don't generate much of an immune response to many of breast cancers. So it hasn't been a disease which has been traditionally treated with immunotherapy. But there are subsets of breast cancer that are particularly aggressive where we've identified immune infiltrates in these cancers. And one of the cancers, which represents about 15 or 20% of breast cancer, but has been a very aggressive and difficult to treat disease, is called triple negative breast cancer. It doesn't respond to hormone manipulations, and it doesn't respond to an antibody called Herceptin or trastuzumab. So we actually have thought that maybe this would be a kind of a cancer that would respond to immunotherapy. Well, with the advent of the PD-1 and PD-L1 inhibitors that you heard about, there was a lot of interest in seeing whether or not we could have some kind of a response with these immunotherapies that would unleash the immune system to act against the cancer in patients who had aggressive cancers, where there's more traditionally these immune infiltrates when you do biopsies. So the studies we did in triple-negative breast cancer using a variety of different immunotherapy agents have shown that a small number of patients with triple-negative breast cancer can respond to immunotherapy. But actually, that rate is much, much lower than melanoma patients. So this is just one patient. It's always nice to see a patient's story who was treated with a single-agent immunotherapy or checkpoint inhibitor-type agent. So this is a 36-year-old woman who had a triple-negative breast cancer. As we do quite frequently, she got chemotherapy first to shrink the cancer before surgery, and she had a curable localized cancer. So she went through and had her surgery, had a little bit of residual cancer, but not much, seemed to be doing well, had her radiation. But unfortunately, just a little over a year later, she relapsed with lung nodules that were found incidentally. She received an oral chemotherapy for 3 months, but actually had no response. The lung nodules grew during that treatment, and then started on a trial that we had, an exploratory trial, looking at a checkpoint inhibitor called pembrolizumab, Keytruda, which you heard about earlier, one of the first immunotherapies really to be studied in cancer. This was a single-agent trial, so she had that lung nodule, and you can see on here that there's the little lung nodule there. I'm just showing you the one that's easy to see. And actually, shortly after she started, she went to Mexico with her family, and she came back from Mexico with some diarrhea, and she lives a distance away. So she called us. She said, everybody has diarrhea. We're like, okay, take an antibiotic. And you know, in breast cancer, we didn't give a lot of immunotherapy before we started this trial. So then she called us a couple weeks later, and she said, I took the antibiotics. I'm still having a diarrhea. So then I actually had just had a patient have an immune colitis, and so we were very suspicious about this. We brought her in. We did a colonoscopy, and we found that there were immune cells, lymphocytes, that were infiltrating the wall of her bowel. And that's actually when you take the break off of the immune system, sometimes, thankfully infrequently, your immune system can attack you along with the cancer, and that's a bit of a problem. So we were actually able to give her an oral non-absorbable steroid called budesonide. Symptoms went away, and gradually, still on the same drug, she could taper off that steroid and the diarrhea didn't come back, which is very interesting. Like, you adjust over time. Meanwhile, her tumor continued to shrink. And you can see here, just about 1 year out after starting this pembrolizumab, which she receives as an IV infusion every 3 weeks and is otherwise well, she has very little disease, just really a scar in her lung. So this is really encouraging data. But what does it mean for all of our patients? This is a common cancer, breast cancer. And I've showed you here some, you saw some pictures before, but here's the T cells in an untreated breast cancer that are infiltrating the breast cancer itself. So there have been a lot of investigators that have looked at these lymphocytes to see whether or not we can predict outcome. And what's been very interesting is that in patients who have the most aggressive forms of breast cancer, the more of those immune cells you have in the cancer, the better your cancer responds to chemotherapy and the better you do. So the whole idea is that maybe we could figure out exactly how to get more of an immune response, so we're manipulating your own response to cancer, and treat the cancers more effectively and, of course, prevent the recurrent incurable cancers. So we know that breast cancer can induce this immune response, but it doesn't happen very frequently, and it only happens in our most aggressive cancers that have these lymphocytes called T cells that you heard about earlier infiltrating the tumor. And there are these specific, now we understand, there are specific T cells that infiltrate the tumor, and those ones are associated with better outcomes. So it's not just having an immune response. You got to have the right immune response. You know, you keep going down levels and finding out more and more. You want to engineer the immune response to be the right one, the one that's helpful for you. So what happened? Well, I showed you that very nice response in a patient. But now there are a couple of studies that have looked at the two, I think, most commonly studied immune checkpoint inhibitors in breast cancer, certainly, in patients who have this triple-negative aggressive breast cancer. And the response rates are under 10%. That means if you treat 100 patients, about 8 patients have a significant shrinkage in their tumor. That's a really small number. So, of course, our goal is to try and improve this. The most common subset of breast cancer is hormone receptor positive disease. That's the kind where you take tamoxifen or another hormone blocking agent to treat it. Those cancers are really slow growing. and they don't generate an immune response. They look like us, so we don't try and reject the cancers. So a lot of our goal moving forward in breast cancer is to try and engineer an immune response that's better. You heard about that cute terminology, ipi-nivo, from melanoma. Well, that's the whole idea, is that somehow by combining these agents, you might be able to further improve the ability of your own body to kill these cancers. So we're doing a number of different things, and I'm just showing you this one design that we will be starting up later this year. But one thing we found that's kind of intriguing is that chemotherapy, the standard chemotherapy we give, it causes an immune infiltration. So a lot of the trials that are going on now are combining these immune checkpoint inhibitors with chemotherapy in the treatment of breast cancer. And we have some very interesting trials actually treating patients who have bigger cancers before surgery, curable breast cancer, to try and see who responds. You give that immune therapy plus chemotherapy, and then you can actually see what happens at the time of surgery. We want to try and enhance that immune response. So there's a lot of work going on by my colleagues in the laboratory trying to look at what agents might actually enhance that infiltration of T cells into the tumor. So our colleagues at Vanderbilt have actually looked at a pathway called MEK, and they found that if you inhibit the MEK pathway, that you can enhance the immune infiltration because MEK can suppress that immune response. We also know that there are now pathways that actually cause an immune response, and the tumor shuts them down a little bit. So maybe if we stimulated that target, you could stimulate the immune response. Those drugs are called immune agonists. They increase the immune response. So our idea was maybe if we tried to combine these different agents with a checkpoint inhibitor, and this particular study is using the drug avelumab, a checkpoint inhibitor, we might be able to first enhance your body's attempt to respond in an immunologic way against the cancer, and then you come up with a checkpoint inhibitor and unleash that response, take away the blockade. So in this trial in patients who have triple-negative breast cancer, who have advanced incurable breast cancer, we'll be giving these agents, either the MEK inhibitor, these two immune agonists, which have really long names, so I left them out of here. They don't have brand names yet. And then we give them for a couple of weeks, see what's happened to the cancer by doing a tumor biopsy. Did you increase the immune cells that are in that cancer? Did it do what you wanted? And then you come in with a checkpoint inhibitor and see what happens in terms of responses. In addition to just see how the cancers respond, we're also going to see how the patients are doing. So we do something called PROs, which is the patients fill out questionnaires and tell us how they're tolerating the treatment, how it's going. And this is really the way we're going to be assessing all of these treatments moving forward. We want something that works and works better, and it's less toxic, or at least we can control the toxicity. So this trial, actually, we were fortunate enough, it's a collaboration between a number of different institutions in our translational breast cancer research consortium that's funded by funds from a number of different groups. And one is the Breast Cancer Research Foundation that was started by actually Louder Money and funds a number of different researchers internationally. So this is going to fund actually 10 different institutions to collaborate on this trial, because for sure in what we're doing, it takes a village and everybody's support. Thanks.
All right. So, you know, it's really remarkable to think about, you know, where the field has been, and just thinking about Van's comments, you know, 20 years ago, you know, when I was a trainee, I actually remember sitting in the office of a famous professor at another medical school in the Bay Area. Actually being told that immunotherapy would never work in a solid tumor. And so I kind of thought about that and thought that those were inspirational words. Fortunately, I was not proven wrong, but I think it really shows how the field and how our perceptions of what's possible with the immune system has really changed. And so now as a treating oncologist, we actually think about immunotherapy along the same lines that we think about surgery or radiation therapy or chemotherapy. And so it's really a different time, and it's really been an exciting one, as we've heard from all of these talks. And so, you know, I thought I'd, you know, talk about what our goal is with immunotherapy. And in many ways, you know, this is not unlike what happens with other cancer treatments, where we treat our patients, and unfortunately, a small proportion of those patients actually benefit from those treatments. And, you know, as we think about these, we really need to learn to try to improve upon these rates of success. And so, you know, what often happens in different cancers is we can actually select out what patient might respond. And so both Adil and Hope talked about this necessary requirement to have this specific flavor of a T cell in their tumor. And that could be a way by which we could actually select out patients. And a lot of companies are actually developing, and as well as investigators, are developing these diagnostics to select out these patients. But ultimately, our hope with immunotherapy, as with other cancers, is actually to learn from our patients what's going on and what's wrong with that specific individual, and then actually to tailor the therapy so that we can get many more of our patients to respond to treatment. I think the challenge with immunotherapy is we're just not thinking about the tumor, but as Lewis commented, we also need to think about the immune system that's within that person. And you actually need to have both of these actually working together and responding to a treatment in order for us to actually see this shift in paradigm where we can have more people responding to treatment. And in order to get to that point, we really need to learn so much more about what these treatments are doing in people. Now, just to give you a sense of what's going on here at UCSF, what I did was actually put up some of the different cancers that we're actually studying with immunotherapies, and this is not a complete list. But, you know, sort of broken on the top here are cancers where now this anti-PD-1 antibody is an FDA-approved therapy. And, you know, this list is actually expanding by the month, actually. But we have studies going on in these cancers. But more importantly, as Hope alluded to, there are actually a lot of other cancers that don't respond very well to immunotherapies or as well as we'd like to, and obviously breast cancer is one of those diseases. And so we've really made a concerted effort at UCSF to focus not just where we have signal, where we know that these treatments can work, but actually to think about other cancers where we really need to make some advances to get these to work better. The other thing that I want to highlight is in terms of the approaches that are being studied with regards to immunotherapy, we can actually think about these immune checkpoint inhibitors or, you know, the anti-PD-1 or anti-CTLA-4 that we've heard about. We can think about these immune agonists that Hope introduced, as well as cytokine therapies or vaccines. We have studies where we're actually injecting treatments into the tumors. We also need to think about conventional cancer therapies as immunotherapies, and it has been borne out. Chemotherapy, radiation therapy, some of these targeted therapies that we use, we thought were actually acting on the cancer cell in terms of killing the cancer cells. But in fact, many of these actually require a functional immune system to work. And in fact, these may actually serve as immunotherapies. And then also thinking about these engineered T cells that are really transforming some of these different therapies, some of these different diseases that we're thinking about. And so there's really a whole host of different modalities that are being studied at UCSF. And the final point that I just want to highlight is those cancers that are highlighted in red are cancers where we're taking this multi-pronged approach that Hope introduced, where we're really trying to look at all these different combinations. Because as you might imagine, we've got a lot of different therapies that we might want to use in combination. And so we actually have programs in these diseases that are highlighted in red where we're making this concerted effort to figure out how we put all this together. So the final slide that I had was what we're doing to understand what these treatments are doing in our patients. And I think, you know, when we think about immunotherapy, you know, as Lewis alluded to, in the laboratory, we've been curing mice for a long period of time. Now we've made that shift into people. And rather than just thinking about a treatment as something that we deliver, we actually view this as really an important opportunity for us to learn as much as we can from it. And so what we've managed to build at UCSF is a way where we can think about all of these individuals who actually participate with us in these different clinical trials. We can actually take blood samples, or we could take tumors through biopsies or surgical resection, and we can actually subject them to a whole host of different immune assays. And I'm not going to go through these. I just want you to give a sense of how we're trying to use all the technologies we have available here to bear to address this question. And sort of tacked on the end here is the microbiome. This is the bacteria that's in the stool. And again, thinking about how that might actually influence how immunotherapies work. And then, you know, really trying to put this all together. And so while we're collecting all this information, we really need to actually integrate this in a way where we can see who actually responds or who doesn't respond and figure out why that is. And so with that, I'll just end, and I guess we'll have a Q&A session. All right, thank you.
So just as an introduction, I think everyone knows that chemotherapy has certain side effects. So the question is, what are the side effects of immunotherapy?
Well, there are a lot of side effects to immunotherapy. I think, a lot of the side effects are due to overactivation of the immune system. And for the PD-1 drugs, I think the side effects can include, you know, like Hope was saying.
The colitis.
Colitis, diarrhea, skin rashes, some hormone deficiencies like thyroid hormone deficiencies, endocrine, you know, like insulin, like diabetes. It can also include, rarely, but some heart problems and nerve problems. I think a lot of those side effects can be reversed by giving people, you know, things like steroids. So we've had to relearn some of the lessons that we have from chemotherapy, because a lot of those rules don't apply. You know, we still have surgeons calling us and saying, hey, you know, Mr. Smith got treatment, like, you know, chemotherapy, like on Monday. Is it safe for him to be operated on Tuesday? Well, actually, it is safe. It's not, you know, you're not at high risk of developing infections and stuff like that. But it's been a different world. I mean, some of the side effects, like for instance, we had this patient who had normal sugar, and then one day, for no apparent reason, had a sugar that was high. And it's because that person developed diabetes. And So I think there's a lot of interesting work that's being done on what exactly you need to do to suppress that or to restore body function. And I think as we get into the setting where we're using multiple immunotherapies stacked on top of each other, I think that could be a bigger problem.
Yeah, today I just passed on to Larry, the NCI and the NIH just put out an initiative to study these patients to see if you can predict who's going to have the off-target autoimmune side effects of these therapies, because it doesn't happen to everyone. Again, if you could perhaps prognostically figure out who's going to suffer this, you can tailor the treatment so that you avoid it and give them the best treatment that activates their immune system against the cancer. But if you know they're at a high risk for blowing out their pituitary gland on CTLA-4 therapy, or if they're going to get colitis from ipilimumab, you might be able to tailor the therapy to avoid the side effects, and the NIH has just put out a new initiative to fund that.
So it's another example of precision medicine, if you will, which
exactly
is custom to that one individual patient.
Yeah. So if we can predict who's going to get the autoimmune side effect, we can tailor the therapy accordingly.
It's actually really interesting. In breast cancer, you know, we hadn't used those agents, so we were kind of, I think, surprised in some ways by the immune, you know, we'd call up a deal and say, oh, so is this what you see, you know? And but one of the things we do in breast cancer that may be a little different than some of the other cancers is that if a patient's been on a checkpoint inhibitor, they might go on chemotherapy afterwards. And we don't really know what that does to the immune response, because we already know that the chemotherapy by itself causes this immune response and infiltrate of immune cells. So we've actually seen now, both in the early and late stage breast cancer setting, some immune toxicities or side effects in people who got the checkpoint inhibitor, then they got the chemotherapy, and 90 to 120 days later, you're seeing this immune side effect. And what's interesting is in some other cancers, they've seen that where the cancers seem to regress faster than you would expect or shrink more from the chemotherapy. So it's possible that that kind of off-target toxicity somehow has some indication of the cancer responding. But what was most surprising to us was seeing these very, very late, you know, two doses of a checkpoint inhibitor, cancer grows, get another chemotherapy, and 4 months later you get the colitis. So there's something clearly going on where we're changing the balance. It may be that that helps people do better in the long run, and that's what we're going to need to find out.
Okay, I'm ready for the next question. I think I'm going to first ask Dr. Fong to hit this one. And because you have the 20-year experience in immunotherapy, and this question is about key technologies that are needed to be created or improved to enable immunotherapy to be more, either more targeted or more successful, and maybe also talk about what have been the technologies in the 20 years since you started, what technologies have come along in that 20 years that has enabled us to get where we are. And I'm talking about, you know, some of the data technology, genome technology, whatever. And then what do we need going forward in new technologies?
That's a simple question.
Yeah. And you have 2 minutes.
How much time do we have? Well, you know, what we are doing now, I would not have dreamed about 20 years ago. And it's hard for me to speculate how these technologies will evolve. But I think, you know, what's very clear are we're really tapping into all these discoveries that are advancing science as a whole forward, but applying them in the context of immunotherapy. So you mentioned sequencing, and that obviously has made a huge impact in terms of what we do. There's also been a lot of work trying to study cells at a single cell level. You know, historically, we've always studied cells, you know, all together as a pool, and it's really hard to tease out what's going on, like, in a very specific immune cell. And so that's another area that has really moved forward. There's a host of different technologies that involve trying to tease apart what's in a tissue. So if we take a surgical resection or a biopsy, how can we gain information from that? And there are a whole host of technologies that allow us to tease out information that we otherwise would not be able to do. But really, the whole landscape has changed even over these last 2 or 3 years, how we're actually following our patients. I think, you know, one of the biggest needs we have is that box I put on the side of my slide, which is the bioinformatics. In that, as we generate all this data, we as scientists can only really comprehend a very small portion of that. And so this is really another area where, you know, is a huge opportunity. And, you know, I'm hoping we can leverage a lot of the firepower in the Bay Area to help us understand, you know, this information, because it's one where we really need to integrate it and think about it in a different way than we historically have.
So, I mean, IBM is pushing their Watson system as a way to maybe address some of the things you're talking about.
Yeah, you know, all, you know, machine learning and Google has a huge effort now in this area. There are actually new members of the faculty here at UCSF that were leaders in a lot of these different companies. And we've really been reaching out to these individuals, too, just to try to glean as much as we can.
So I think you touched on this in the presentation a little bit already, but I think it may be worth going into it a little bit more in the question session here. And the question is, how does traditional chemotherapy synergize with immunotherapy? I think you've commented on this a little bit in the presentations, but are there any other parts of that you want to cover?
Yeah, I mean, this is basic immunology 101. So you have
we're at the 101 level.
Yes. So you have these specialized cells that like to pick up debris and present it to your immune system to get the immune response started. And that happens all the time with infectious disease, like when a virus kills your cells, when it infects your cells. That debris is picked up by these specialized cells that then get the T cells and B cells going. So chemotherapy is a way in which you can create debris that gets eaten then by the appropriate cells. These are called dendritic cells. And then that's what kickstarts the whole process. So I think that in its simplest form, there's probably many other more sophisticated mechanisms by which chemotherapy works. But the simple one is it creates the debris that these cells like to eat and present to their neighbors.
It's interesting, actually, because not all chemotherapy does that particularly well. And some chemotherapy drugs are better at causing an immune infiltrate than others. And some chemotherapy drugs, I mean, obviously, we all, I think, understand that chemotherapy is made up of many different agents, and they have many different side effects. Some chemotherapy cause your hair to fall out. Other chemotherapy doesn't. And, you know, some cause mouth sores, GI, you know, diarrhea, things like that, rashes. Others don't. And so there is a balance between what the chemotherapy is doing and what we call, and you heard about this before, off-target toxicity. So you're trying to kill the cancer cell. But at the same time, you know, the problem with chemotherapy is you kill other rapidly dividing cells. So that might be your hair, for example, or the lining of your GI tract.
Or your immune cells.
Or your immune cells. And then you're doing something worse, right? So you might be causing an immune infiltrate, but you're also in the tumor, but you're also suppressing the immune system. So understanding how that all fits together is interesting. And, you know, we heard from Lewis who talked about doing studies in mice, which is incredibly important. But and you could correct me if I'm wrong. I think of mice as having a relatively simpler immune system. And so that sometimes what we see in humans doesn't exactly fit.
I mean, the real advantage.
But I thought these mice were all engineered, so they are exactly like us. That's the pitch I heard.
When they get on two legs and walk around, they'll be like us.
Yeah.
Yes. But I think that's true. But we have to. We're actually able to do now experiments in people. It's sophisticated enough now that we can take, I say, you know, we're like mice now. We have these patients who are getting, you can get the tissues and the cells before the immunotherapy. You can then get them a week later. You can then get them a month later. And with all of these new technologies, you can study what happens in you. And that's what's really changed in the last, particularly 5 years. We have the technical capacity to, in very sophisticated ways, you are the mouse now.
Okay.
So we can learn from you. That's what we're doing, and taking the patients who get the therapies, who respond. You say, what did their immune system do? Versus the one who didn't respond, what are their immune system doing? Because it will be personalized. With mice, there are, you know, all sorts of different strains of mice. You got the brown ones and the black ones and the white ones, and they respond differently. Well, everybody in this room responds differently. So in a mouse system, you have the luxury of focusing down on one mouse where it works. But dirty little secret is that same therapy may not work in the white mouse. But
okay.
That's just like people.
Okay, so we have one final question, and this one may take you outside your comfort zone. So this is not maybe what you're expecting, but the question is this. Government funding for NIH is at risk of major cutbacks by our newly elected president and Congress. How would you think such cutbacks could affect your programs and research, And are you personally willing to get involved in lobbying the government to prevent these cuts? Or even better, go for increased funding? Because it seems like we're at a real turning point in terms of what we're doing, and we need more funding, not less funding.
March on Saturday.
Yeah.
Well, I think this is something that UCSF is one of the top institutions in terms of getting money from the NIH and the government, and so
which means they could be affected.
We would be impacted most significantly, and so this is where a lot of the research that we're doing that we're highlighting here, unfortunately, only a small proportion of that is actually funded by the NIH. Partly because it's so challenging to get NIH money. And so this is, a component where, we are actually so grateful to the community here at UCSF because, your contribution and your support of UCSF actually is critical to our mission. We wouldn't actually be able to do it. And in these uncertain times, it actually makes that much more important.
I think that, it's very difficult, particularly when you move into the clinical and translational world, to use some of our funding mechanisms to fully fund these trials, clinical trials, because they take a little while to do, and funding has specific time intervals. And then there's taking care of the patients, which is costly, and then doing the laboratory correlates to try and have the people who are enrolled in the trials actually inform who's going to respond and who isn't. So funding has always been an issue for us. I think thinking about having our most important source of funding that really, I think, has funded the structure of our research be markedly reduced at a time when we're making great strides and changes is really very scary and threatening for all of us. So I think that we all have to stand up and be vocal. I think that's our responsibility right now as members of the scientific and medical community and members of our community at large. That having been said, even in the current environment, for example, the study I showed in our consortium is funded only partially, but it's funded by philanthropic funds through the Breast Cancer Research Foundation, and now we're looking for the funds. That's just the clinical part. For the laboratory correlates, we have to find additional funding. So these are, even in the current era, having a broad-based way of trying to do these studies is critical for us, and I think that we can't lose one arm of it. So.
Okay. Yeah, my biggest worry is the next generation. I mean, I can retire and I'm fine, but who I worry about now are the 30-year-olds and 40-year-olds. If they see cuts like this, they will become so disillusioned.
They might become venture capitalists like my partner.
Yeah, they could be venture capitalists. But we need people at the bench.
Yeah, exactly.
We partner with our pharmaceutical partners a lot to fund a lot of clinical trials and translational research laboratory studies as well. But it's really important to have independent work as well that's not solely funded by the person who's making the agent, because that directs your research in a certain way. And some of the big advances have really come from people thinking outside of the box and taking the risks you can only take for what we call investigator-initiated research as opposed to the sponsor who's going to be more risk-averse in terms of looking at those new ideas.
So we've run out of time, and I think I opened a box here that we need like an extra half hour to discuss. Yes. But it was great to hear your views on this, and thank you all very much. And thank you, Bob.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.